Kurt Timmermeister worked for years as a chef and restaurateur in Seattle before he decided to leave that life to be a small-scale farmer on Vashon Island in the Puget Sound. In his new book, Growing a Feast, the Chronicle of a Farm-to-Table Meal, he tells the story of a meal that begins years before it's served with the birth of a calf whose milk would be made into cheese and butter. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Kurt Timmermeister, excuse me, I'm getting all choked up about this. It's brought him back to our show. Welcome back to our show.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to be here.
How big is your farm and what do you grow on it?
It's 13 acres.
So it's small.
I think it's pretty big, but it's not Indiana farm, certainly not. But it's good size. It's something that I can take care of, and it's mostly in pasture now. We mostly just raise cows, Jersey cows, for milk for cheese.
And Jersey cows, the best cows for that?
I think so.
They produce the most butterfat?
High butterfat, lower volume. Plus, they're really beautiful creatures, and I like them. I like the scale of them. I like who they are.
Do you let the calves nurse?
For a short period of time, but not for very long.
Did you know much about farming when you first bought the land?
Probably nothing. Nothing at all. I've learned a few things over the couple of decades.
So what were your earliest ideas of what you would do with the farm?
Originally, it was just going to be my home. I mean, that's what I started for probably the first decade. And then I tried vegetables, growing vegetables for market. Didn't do real well at that, I must admit.
Why is that? Is it the land?
The land is not great. It's not great, really high quality soil for vegetables. Pasture, we've done a great job with it. I tried cider apples for a bit for making hard cider. That didn't work too good either. But the cheese now is extraordinary. That's the good news.
The cheese actually requires work. I mean, growing apples, you plant the trees and then you pick the apples when they're ready. But making cheese, you actually have to have some artisanal skills, which I assume you had because you were a chef.
I think I know what I want cheese to be, and I love cheese, and I can eat it every day, and it's a constant education, and we're good at it.
Were your notions about farming more romantic than the actual work turned out to be?
I'm embarrassed to say yes. I was like so many people that you really don't enjoy your day-to-day job, and you dream of this very pastoral life, and I fell into it, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. And that's when I was trying vegetables and trees, and I was like, this is really difficult.
And then you restored an original log house on the property?
Yeah, I live in this just extraordinary house that is the oldest house on Vashon. It's 1880, which for that part of the country is rather old. And it's beautiful. It's really stunning.
Well, log cabins were the norm in that area.
Yeah, absolutely.
A former staff member moved to Seattle, and she lives in a modern house. And in the middle of the house is a log cabin, which is her dining room. And then everything else was added on to this original log cabin.
Because a lot of them, I mean, they tended to be fairly small and sometimes dark. This one actually is also fairly small, but it had beautiful windows, and so it's actually kind of graceful.
Your book is about all the elements that went into creating one meal on your farm. Where did your Sunday dinner ritual come from?
I had owned restaurants for almost two decades, and I sold the last one because I was really burned out and I was very exhausted from it.
What kind of restaurants were
there? A large, kind of bustling, open breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week, almost 24 hours a day. And I thought I never wanted to have any part of it again. And then after a couple of years, I realized I really love serving people. I love making food. I didn't want a big city restaurant, but I started doing these dinners, and it was 20 people would come out to the farm and have dinner.
Did you invite them, or did they hear about it and make reservations?
I originally sent out a small email to, maybe a couple dozen people, and some came, and then it just it just took off by word of mouth.
Well, you're on an island where you have to take a ferry to get there.
which you would think would be kind of a liability. It actually was a tremendous asset that if you lived in the city, you had to make an effort. And the ferry is this tremendous, like, emotional or mental disconnect where you stop and you have to sit on this boat. And then when you land, you have a different experience, a complete experience.
Did the dinners help to support the forum?
They did quite well, yeah.
But then you decided to stop.
I did. I have a short attention span. I like to be challenged. I want things that are new and exciting, and I want to learn new things.
Well, for somebody with a short attention span, you write about a very long process.
Yes.
And you begin with the birth of a calf.
Right.
This aspect of farming, dealing with animal breeding and birthing, seems like it would be the most challenging.
I think it was. I didn't grow up with animals, certainly. So you have to learn it all. I had grown up growing, you know, vegetables and so on and plants. But there's such a responsibility that's involved where you can't quit. You have to follow this through, and you have to be really responsible to these animals. And I think that draws you in, and that gets you to understand the gravity of it and do a very good job.
And that calf, Alice,
yes,
winds up providing milk for butter that's used in your meal. Also,
right,
the milk for cheese.
Yes.
How much can one cow supply?
The cows produce about 5 gallons a day each. That calf contributed to the production of the cheese.
Gallons. How much cheese comes out of 5 gallons of milk?
We usually make a make of cheese now every day. It's 35 gallons, and it makes about 100 of these Camembert-style cheeses. So that kind of volume.
Well, there's a restaurant in Tarrytown, uh-huh, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, where they serve one cow butters, and they give you a butter made from one cow and another butter from another cow, and you can taste the difference.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. Have you ever tried that?
I haven't tried that cow to cow. We always blend it with all the cows that are in milk, and then we let the cream rise and skim it and churn it and so on.
And you say you make a couple of different cheeses.
I do. Primarily a Camembert style. It's called Dinah's cheese, and that's what we were doing for a few years. And then we're making a Tome style cheese called Log House, and we age that in an underground cheese cave now.
And you also have Francesca's cheese.
Francesca's cheese is the one that is talked about in the book. It's a hard cheese. It's aged for a couple of years. We're still – very little of it has ever been sold. It was used for the dinners, and I'm still working on it to actually bring it to market. And because the aging is so long that to refine it takes a tremendous amount of time.
It takes a year and a half between
a half,
making
years,
it and it being ready to eat?
Right.
Why does it take so long? Does it just have to
– it has to age and kind of cure, and it ends up having this kind of grana texture and little salt crystals, and it's a beautiful thing. It's good.
But then the Dinah cheese is
much
quicker.
Dinah cheese is like 30 days, very quick. So it's easy to refine it and get very good at it after making it.
You say you don't lock anything on your farm, but you do lock up your cheese.
I do. The cheese cave has a fair amount of security to it. It's separate from the house. It's up in the pasture, and it's underground. But, yes, it's well sealed.
And is a cheese cave like a wine cave?
Very similar. It's about 350 square feet, barrel vaulted, cast in place concrete.
You prefer cows to sheep or goats?
Oh, absolutely.
But goat cheeses can be great. Sheep's milk cheese can be great.
I enjoy other people's goat cheese and sheep milk cheese, but we stick with cows.
And why is that?
Mostly it's just I connect to cows. The people that work for me really enjoy them. And we only have so much land, so we have to concentrate on one thing and be very capable at it.
And how do you milk them? Are you doing it the old-fashioned way?
No, there's
it's all mechanical?
It's mechanical, but not in a grand sense. I mean, mechanical is kind of a big word for it. We milk them twice a day, 7 days a week.
My guest is Kurt Timmermeister. He was on our show a while back when he wrote a book called Growing a Farmer. The farm has grown a bit since that book, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
It was originally, 4 acres, and now you say about 13
about
acres?
About 13, yeah.
And he has a new book called Growing a Feast, The Chronicles of a Farm-to-Table Meal. It is published by Norton. You also do grow vegetables, but you're not selling them?
We grow a small amount, and for, you know, if we do a party, but It's a lot for this for the people that work for me. I want them to have great meat and great dairy, and I don't want to pay them and then have them go to the grocery store and buy things to eat. So we use it for dinners at the farm now.
Do you have a greenhouse?
Oh yeah, for mostly for plant starts. We'll grow tomatoes and peppers in there as well.
You start it when it's really cold, although it's never as cold in Puget Sound as it is here in New York.
We're close to the water, so it's always pretty temperate.
You say spinach is particularly hard to grow. Why?
It tends to bolt really fast. It's very hard to get it to be beautiful for a long period of time unless you seed it in succession constantly.
And you grow in concrete raised beds, not just straight to the soil?
We created this garden a few years ago that's all raised beds. And the goal was that people coming to the farm could get very close to the plants and see them in whatever the weather, whether it was snowing or raining and so on. When they were in the fields, people wouldn't go there. The people wouldn't – they didn't want to get their feet muddy and so on. And now it's very accessible. As it happens, the beds drain very well because they're kind of raised up. They heat up very well. And the concrete is exceptional. They never rot and so on.
Well, if you're growing in a city like New York, you have to do raised beds.
Absolutely.
Because the soil is just too full of stuff that you don't want to go into your food.
Right.
But that's not a problem in Vashon Island.
No, but we augment the soil that we do have tremendously by the compost we make. We have got a dozen cows, so we have – they're in the barn a lot of the time in the winter when it's raining and snowing. So we'll make – tremendous amount of stuff compost that's cow manure and straw.
You also keep bees, funny.
We keep a couple of hives usually.
Yeah. Now, are you affected by the die-off of the bees?
I wish I knew more about it. I've had more and more trouble keeping bees through the winter, and I assume it's the same die-off that they're talking about. But I used to be much better at it in the past, and I keep thinking it's me that like. I'm just not as skilled as I used to be, but I'm starting to realize that I'm part of the die-off as well. It must be that.
Do the bees go across the Sound to?
Oh, I think so.
Into Seattle.
Oh yeah, I'm assuming they do. It's not a very big channel separating the island.
Now from you keep cows.
Yes.
Do you slaughter any of them for meat?
We do. We'll usually slaughter a cow once a year. Depending on how big the cow is, if it's very large, we'll bring in a butcher. If it's smaller, we'll slaughter it there. And it's divided up among the people that work for me. They each get a share of the cow. And it's that kind of ritual is a great day on the farm when we all break it down and take our share.
Can you taste the difference in your meat compared to what you might buy at a supermarket or even a quality butcher shop?
I think so. I mean – it's hard to say now because I eat almost exclusively the beef that we produce. And it's Jersey cow meat. I think it's exceptional.
The same cows that are giving you the milk are giving you the meat.
Absolutely.
How old do you let them become before you do that?
It depends. If it's a steer, a male cow, a castrated male cow, we'd keep it a year and a half or so. If it's a female that we've used for milking, if there becomes some kind of problem with the cow, then we would slaughter it. And it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years, it might be 15 years.
Well, they stop producing milk at a certain point, don't they?
They'll keep producing for quite a long period of time. It's more, is it very, very high quality and healthy milk? That's more the clincher.
Do you find that you're approaching cooking differently when you grow all this stuff that you're using as your ingredients?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been a long time now, so it's how I think now. We go to the gardens, and if the spinach looks good, we make something of spinach, and the ideas certainly start in the field or so on.
This is a tradition that you find all throughout Europe, and we're seeing a little more in this country.
Right.
But why do you think it hasn't taken off here? Why do you think that we don't have chefs growing their own produce the way you do in all throughout France and Italy?
I think they are more so, more and more. It's certainly more difficult. I mean, it's hard to go out there and like find exactly what you want. It's so easy to pick up the phone and order. I need a case of this, a case of this, a case of this, and it miraculously shows up on the loading dock tomorrow morning, kind of thing. But I think we're absolutely going that way, and I'm excited about it. Like Blue Hill, as you mentioned earlier, they do it and very well at it.
I ate at a farm in Amsterdam once. It's called The Farm.
Nice.
And you're in the middle of a greenhouse, and on all around you are other greenhouses that are producing the stuff you're going to eat.
I think that's what we should do. It's a little more complicated, a little more work, but I think the result and the payoff is extraordinary.
One of the things on the menu of the meal that you write about in this book is pizza. That surprised me.
Why does it surprise you?
Well, you know, this sounds like very homey kind of food, but you have your own pizza oven?
Yeah, there's a wood-fired pizza oven just outside the kitchen door. And it's a lot of it is besides the fact I like pizza. It's a way to start a meal nicely where people are sharing something while they're walking around with a glass of wine and so on. And it works really well for that. And it's exciting to watch it. You know, the pizza's coming out of the oven one after the other. And they're super fresh. You know, they come right out of this super hot oven. They're put on a table and cut and people grab them. And I want people to experience that and see that dynamic nature.
You also serve a tomato upside down cake for dessert. Tomato.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Well, tomato is a fruit.
It is a fruit. It's not a vegetable. It's kind of emblematic of the whole thing of like we don't really need to bring in a pineapple from Hawaii and cut it up and put a cherry in the middle and make pineapple upside down cake. We have extraordinary fruit here. It happens to be tomatoes, and they're full of flavor and they're interesting and they're different types and varieties and colors, and they make a remarkable cake. I love
it. So are people surprised when they discover that the dessert is tomato?
I think so. I hope they're a little surprised. I want people to think about their meal and what they're eating more so than they do.
Another dish you serve is poached egg on lacinato kale with béarnaise sauce, which sounds really delicious. Your own eggs?
Oh, absolutely. So they're beautiful golden pastured eggs. They're always on grass every day in these coops that move around these chicken tractors.
Now, lacinato kale is also called Tuscan kale, an Italian kale. Is it different than other kinds of kale?
Absolutely. It looks completely different than like a winter boar or a Russian kale. I mean, flat and kind of scaly, dino kale it's called sometimes.
Yeah. Is February an easy time to be away from the farm and be on a book tour?
It's very strange to be off the farm, I must admit. I love New York and I've had a great time, but I keep having the guys at the farm send me pictures of my dog because I miss them and the cows and stuff. But, it's weird to be away. Absolutely.
But you're doing the book tour, and then you'll be back in time for the spring planting.
I imagine. I'll be back in a couple of days. Yeah. Back to work making cheese.
And meanwhile, you give us recipes and also I think probably inspire some people to try. I'm not going to put cows in my backyard, but –
You know, I want people to look at what they're eating. That's all I ask, is to think about the stories behind meals and behind their food and find those great stories because they're behind all of our food.
Well, as somebody who has had some failures and successes in growing things, if somebody were starting and wanted to grow their own vegetables other than tomatoes, which the only problem in New York is that the squirrels get them, what would you recommend?
You know, the ones that kind of my first thing is I love salad that's super, super fresh, like beautiful greens and so on. And if you can get into a good routine of like seeding them every, 14 days or something, then you have these really beautiful greens. The greens in the store, they don't feel quite the same to me. I like really fresh, beautiful sweet lettuce right out of the garden. And it's easy to grow.
You can grow squash as well in New York. I don't know whether you grow it there. Kurt Timmermeister, his latest book is Growing a Feast, The Chronicle of Farm-to-Table Meal. It is published by Norton. And it's been a pleasure talking with you again.
Absolutely. Thank you.